You're listening to the podcast of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, which airs weekly on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Juliana Baggett, whose new novel, Harriet Wolfe's Seventh Book of Wonders, came out last month from Little Brown. Critically acclaimed best-selling author Juliana Baggett, who also writes under the pen names Bridget Asher and Annie Bode, has published more than 20 books, including novels for adults, young readers, and a collection of poetry. Her latest novel, Harriet Wolfe's Seventh Book of Wonders, was published in August 2015. Her novel, Pure, was the first of a trilogy and was a New York Times Notable Book of 2012 and received the ALA's Alex Award. Pure is in development to be made into a movie. Juliana Baggett's work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, Best American Poetry, Best Creative Nonfiction, Real Simple, on NPR.org, as well as read on NPR's Talk of the Nation and Here and Now. Her novels have been book pick selections by People Magazine's Summer Reading, Washington Post Book of the Week, a Book Sense selection, a Boston Herald Book Club selection, and a Kirkus Best Books of the Year list. Her novels have been published in over 50 overseas editions. She's a professor in the College of Motion Picture Arts at Florida State University and holds the Jenks Chair at the College of the Holy Cross. The reclusive Harriet Wolfe, revered author and family matriarch, has a final confession, a love story. Years after her death, as her family comes together one last time, the mystery of Harriet's life hangs in the balance. Does the truth lie in the rumored final book of the series that made Harriet a world-famous writer, or will her final confession be lost forever? Harriet Wolfe's Seventh Book of Wonders tells the moving story of the unforgettable Wolfe women in four distinct voices: the mysterious Harriet, who until now has never revealed the secrets of her past, her fiery, overprotective daughter, Eleanor, and her two grown granddaughters, Tilton, the fragile yet exuberant younger sister who's become a housebound hermit, and Ruth, the older sister who ran away at 16 and never looked back. When Eleanor is hospitalized, Ruth decides it's time to do right by a pact she made with Tilton long ago, to return home and save her sister. Meanwhile, Harriet whispers her true life story to the reader. It's a story that spans the entire 20th century and is filled with mobsters, outcasts, a lonesome lion, and a home for wayward women. It's also a tribute to her lifelong love of the boy she met at the Maryland School for Feeble-Minded Children. Harriet Wolfe's Seventh Book of Wonders offers a profound meditation on motherhood and sisterhood, as well as on the central importance of stories. It is a novel that affords its characters that rare chance we all long for, the chance to reimagine the stories of our lives while there's still time. Juliana Baggett has said that it took her 18 years to write this book from first considering it. When I spoke with her last week, I began by asking her if it was a little bit strange to have the book out in the world now after so much time.
It's always strange. Yeah. I'm not great at going public in a way. I think that there's just something about it that I'll never quite get used to, even though I've published a ton of books. But yeah, I think especially that since this one was with me for such a long time, and I certainly wasn't working on it all the time. I walked away from it because it was kind of a crisis of confidence, and I didn't feel like I was the right writer for it a lot of times, even though it was my idea. So yeah, I was always writing a lot of other things while still working on it here and there.
Okay. All right. Great. So the premise of the book, part of the premise of the book, has to do with a missing book. And I feel like readers are always really excited about storylines that have missing things, missing books even. And it just really pulled me in. So before we start to talk about the narrators and your wonderful characters, I just wondered if you could talk about writing about a missing book and if that's where the story began for you or if it began somewhere else for you.
It began somewhere else. But, you know, I will say that, you know, it's archetypal that we are searchers. You know, we are always searching.
Right.
So if there's something, some way to make that manifest for the reader, that sense of something being missing, going missing, searching for something, I think that that's somewhat psychologically resonant with, you know, humanity, the human experience. So no, it's not where I started. The first part was really all the historical work.
Okay.
So I was reading about Shepherd Pratt, the mental institution in Baltimore, which is this long, fantastic, fascinating history about how they treat mental illness humanely. And then I saw this little mention of the Maryland School for Feeble-Minded Children,
yeah.
and that caught my attention, obviously. And I went and visited the grounds of that, these big, huge, massive buildings that were had asbestos warnings on them at the time and had long since been abandoned, but they certainly captured my imagination. And that, so I was working on that larger, kind of sweeping the 20th century timeline. And then I wrote basically like a screenplay that was also, I didn't know that they fit together, but was more about the contemporary storyline. And then I saw how they fit together. And then I kind of had my book.
Okay. All right. I wondered about the history. I was going to ask you about that, but since we're there, I'll go right for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Maryland School for Feeble-Minded Children was a real place. And I have heard in the past that there were programs to sterilize the insane. That's something else that you talk about in here. That you also refer to Ota Benga, the pygmy slave who was displayed in the Bronx Zoo. Just a horrible history there. So how much research, was this pursued research, or was a lot of it stumbled across? You mentioned that you sort of found the Maryland School, but then did you start to pursue individual aspects of how you wanted to research the book?
Yeah, well, I also was, for $20 a year, you could have a membership to the University of Delaware Library. And at that time, you know, we were living under the poverty level. We had a couple kids already. I would drop the kids at my parents and I would have an hour or so at this library. It was fantastic. I mean, it really changed my life and enriched my life. It was my only access to poetry, for example. But I used to really just walk the stacks a lot of times. And I found this very kind of strangely shaped, tall, thin book called Man Bites Dog. And it's an Edwardian clipster. You know, he would clip newspaper articles.
Right.
And a lot of his obsessions were my obsessions. And so I got to kind of bounce off of some of the things that he was seeing there. And then his obsessions and my obsessions became my character's obsessions. And then I kind of got to see them through through her lens. You know, how would she see all these different historical events, you know, going on throughout her life? How would she respond to them? And then also things that I was pulling from just getting used to knowing what 1917 was about in 1918, you know, just kind of getting used to what was going on in those eras and what would she have been compelled to keep?
Right. Okay. And when we're talking about she, you're talking about Harriet Wolfe. She's sort of your main character. The book has four narrators. Harriet's story is sort of told by way of her memoir. And then there are three other narrative points of view, her daughter Eleanor and Eleanor's two children, Ruthie and Tilton. So do you feel like there's a little bit of you in each of these characters? Do you feel like you identify with one more than any other, or
Yeah, I think in some ways as a writer, you know, Harriet allowed me to say a lot of things about writing that I wanted to say.
Right, yeah.
She's a writer, I'm a writer. So I got to really, I mean, in skewed ways and in exaggerated ways, I got to air a lot of the things that I wanted to say.
Yeah.
But in terms of personality, I'm Tilton. I mean, I'm definitely the youngest of four children, actually. But I felt that they left and abandoned me. And I was raised by my parents, who are incredibly loving, and I adore them. I still have like a daily great relationship with them. But my mother was very overprotective of me. And so in many ways, the way Tilton sees the world is a very poetic way of seeing the world, but also that very overprotected space that she lives in, which is really just her house.
Yeah.
So it was funny, a friend of mine was just asking me, she told me that she really related to Ruthie. And I said, well, of course you did. You know, she's one of the oldest children and she saved herself and got out of, you know, her own childhood home, was the first to go to college, you know, in her family. So it's interesting. Different people relate to different people in the novel in different ways. But
yeah.
And Ruthie gave me the outlet to talk about academe, you know, which was is always fun for me to riff on
right. Yeah,
my
that was
experience
fun. Yeah, it was
as
fun.
An academic. So it was a little bit of venting there.
And her,
fun.
Her relief at letting go of her thesis, of her dissertation,
yes.
was fantastic.
Right. Yes.
So one last question about Tilton, though. In your own life, did you not fight that that sense of being sheltered and being overprotected? Because Tilton sort of embraces it for a lot of the novels. She just feels like, yeah, Mom's right. I am safest here in this house. So,
I mean, in some ways, you know, obviously it's an exaggeration.
Right.
You know, my mother wanted me to go to college. My mother, you know, she kept me home from school an awful lot, but I was attending school, you know.
Right.
So, and, you know, she wanted me to get married and have a family and have a life and have a career, and she's very encouraging of all those things.
Right.
But in many respects, I didn't fight my mother. I mean, I really did allow her to mother me the way she needed to mother someone, and I still do, I think.
Yeah.
And so there is something symbiotic about that, that I still very much identify as the baby. As a baby, you know? I'm the baby of my family. I'm still a baby.
Yeah.
And when I had my first child, I have four, but my oldest daughter is now 20, and she called her nickname for me is the baby mobster, because I am still babyish in a lot of ways. But on the other hand, like, I have all these connections. I can get things done. I can, if she has a problem, I can solve it, you know? So I'm, you know, I'm both of those things for her. And she's really an oldest child, and we were so thankful when she was born and kind of took over running the household.
That's funny. I wanted to talk about your four narrators a little more. Were they always
yeah.
these four women, or were there any others that you ended up deciding, no, this person doesn't work here, or any changes?
Yeah, I mean, it was. There's so many different versions, but an early version, kind of like Edwin Mulhouse, Stephen Mulhouser's book, it was originally like one of the biographers. Like a
okay.
pale, weedy biographer who was trying to put it all together. A very sad, sad person. And then at one point it was all Epit. It was really Epit's story.
I wondered.
He had become kind of an inventor and a very, had a very different life. And it was really his story at one point in time. So it's gone through very drastic changes.
Yeah. Now, when you make changes, drastic changes, is it hard for you to let go? Like, was it hard for you to let go of Epit as a point of view character, narrator? I mean, he's such a great mm-hmm. character, and he still exists in the book. But was it hard for you to let go of the work you had put into giving him a voice?
It was. There's a little excerpt of that that's published, I think, at Fail Better, like in 2001 or something like that.
Yeah.
But here's the danger for the writers out there, the danger of writing a book over 18 years
yeah.
is that you grow as a writer so much that you really, I really truly wrote, you know, three or four unique books or close to, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, Your own obsessions change, your own interests change, certainly your stylistic ambitions change. And so if I would leave it, and it would be Epit's story, I'd leave it, I'd come back. I didn't have the same interests that the writer I was then and the writer I am. They didn't share the same aspirations for the novel. And so when you leave it, it's really, you start collaborating with a stranger who is your previous self. And Mark Weingartner actually has talked about this. He's a novelist who, he did the Godfather books, and he has a number of novels and other books. And he talks about this really kind of beautifully and painfully,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's not my it's not the way I like to write a book. I really like to try to write one version where I'm completely drowned and I go under.
Yeah.
And then I come up with something whole that then I have to contend with.
Okay. All right. Something came up for me craft-wise when I was reading this that I've never really thought that much about, which is the way that detail and metaphor can coexist to offer a really clear picture of a character's perspective or situation. And I just want to offer you an example from this book. Ruthie's first husband, Jim, has custody of their daughter, Haley, because she chose to live with him. And this is a quote from Ruthie's point of view. He, Jim, teaches her Spanish by taping words to stuff in the house and paints rocks with her. I'm too much like my mother, awkward and clunky at love, too much or too little, like driving with one foot on the gas and one on the brakes, sometimes hitting both at the same time. Mm-hmm. I just loved that, and I loved the way you put those two things together. There's the specificity of his teaching her Spanish by taping words to stuff in the house and painting rocks with her, and I get this image of the two of them at this table. And then this wonderful analogy to driving with one foot on the gas and one on the brakes. Do you think that's something you do consciously to put things like that together?
This is such a great example. I'm going to use it to teach because there's this guy named Mednick who, in the book, he's quoted in the book Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, Daniel Kahneman, the Economist's book, which is fascinating if you read it as a writer.
Okay, yeah.
In any case, the quote is, creativity is associative memory working exceptionally well. Associative memory. Not good memory, not clear memory, associative memory, the memory that hops from one memory to another. So as you're speaking, these are three very distinct things in my memory. And when I'm doing a long commute or somewhere, I might let my mind associatively wander. It's how I write. It's how I create. And I write down little scribble down things that I want to use, and I put them in a literal bin, not a figurative or computer bin, but I keep them in a literal bin on my desk.
Uh-huh.
And so these would be three things. The French words in the house, the Spanish in the house. My house is currently, I mean, we did it like 2 days ago, put up fresh words for my 8-year-old, miroir, but we wrote it out in, you know, in language she could understand.
Wow.
And on the mirror, you know.
Right.
So that is it. The painted rocks is definitely from my sister-in-law, who's a fantastic mother. I learned an incredible amount about mothering from her. Which I remember walking into her house one day. She ended up having 5 kids, but at that point she might have had 3. And there's Bob Marley is blaring, and there's just these big, huge rocks on the dining room table that the kids have messily painted. And I'm like, there's the day. She just is like, what to do? You know what? Go grab some rocks, and let's do paint and put on music. Like, I give up, but beautifully so. And then the third one is how my mother drives.
Oh.
My mother literally drives in an automatic car with one foot on the brake and one foot on the gas. And it has been a point of contention for my parents their entire marriage. So how I use these things changes. So it might be an actual trait that a character has, or it might be used as a metaphor. You know what
yeah.
I mean? It changes how I'm going to use them. It might be details to round out someone's existence, you know?
Right.
Or, yeah, so it changes. It might be an entire plot, or it might be some small character detail. But, yeah, so that's a really great example of one sentence where it's really three pieces of memory that went into it.
And are you pulling them out of the bin and making yourself put them together, or are you using it like, you know, in, you know, you're sort of intellectually putting together things that work for you?
I literally put them in the bin, but I don't usually look through the bin.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? So once they're in the bin, it's like I said to my subconscious, these are important, and I've given thanks to that by noting them and putting them in the bin. And sometimes I do go through the bin when I'm thinking, especially if I'm changing from something. I have written post-apocalyptic dystopian stuff. And if
right,
I'm
right.
moving then to something like realism, I will go through the bin and look for the realism. And sometimes I actually have two different bins to separate those kinds of brain functions, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
Okay. All right, great. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your experience of writing a story within a story, which this book is. There is a story in the story. Harriet's narrative is also a memoir. So did that just feel like writing a fourth point of view to you, or did it feel a little bit different?
What are you considering the story within the story? Are you considering
Harriet's
the story within?
I am, sort of, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, because also there's also within that, there's also the haunting of these novels that she
wrote.
Novels with that are just kind of, you know, shadows, but consistent shadows that move throughout the book.
The Daisy and Weldon novels.
Yeah,
yeah,
the novels that she wrote. And so, and at different points, there was more of that, there's been less of that, you know, but striking the right balance there was kind of tricky. I think my brain naturally works in terms of story within a story within a story.
Yeah.
You know, I think in such about the human existence, you know, in very layered ways, and obviously with memory, you know, being so important and the layering of memory and how, you know, I think it's Grace Paley who says any story told twice is fiction. So how how memory changes story, you know, right. And how it becomes fiction so quickly.
Yeah, although I think now it's creative nonfiction, right?
That's right. Memoir, is memory. You know what I mean? Right. They're just telling memories. They're not telling the truth. Yeah. They're telling memories, which is quite a different thing.
It can be, yeah. The story about Epit and his parents and them leaving him at the Maryland School for the Feeble-Minded Children, that story broke my heart. And it made me wonder if... So I'll just say his mother tells him that they will be back for him, but his father silently shakes his head over her shoulder to let him know the truth. Did you read a lot about the sad stories of the children in this actual school and draw on any of those as you worked on your character's stories, or was this one that you just, it came to you as you were writing and you put it down?
Yeah, I didn't, because I didn't have access to why they were left. I just had numbers and data. I had the 1911 biennial report, which talked about how much they built and worked and dug and, the farming that they did and the sewing that they did, the incredible amount of work that they did as children and child laborers while at the Maryland school. But I didn't know why they were left. But, it's very clear when you look at the pictures, too, that you're not looking at children who seem markedly different than normal children. Occasionally there will be a child with Down syndrome, and you can understand at that time, in that period, institutionalization of the Down syndrome child made sense or was the norm. But in general, you're looking at pretty healthy-looking, normal-looking kids. So I didn't have that the why, but I did see also when the Great Depression hit that the numbers swelled, hugely swelled. Yeah. So that's an indication that children are being dropped off because their parents can no longer feed them. And then I had my own family stories, or my grandmother. My great-grandmother was a madam of a house of prostitution, and she had three kids. Yeah, and she used to put two of her children into an orphan with nuns in an orphanage from time to time. And then she would take them back. So at that time, it wasn't really all that unusual, you know. You could rely on that system, to do whatever you had to do to survive and then come back and get them.
Okay. I want to talk about using just the right object in a scene. And for an example, you give Harriet's father a completely useless cane that he carries sort of just as an affect, I think. And it was so perfect for his character. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about using the right object when you're writing.
Yeah. I was just in the airport and I had a layover that was pretty lengthy the other day. And, a lot of my life is pretty, a little bit of a hermitage. I don't get out necessarily all that much. So I had this opportunity to look at tons of people flying past me, and I had an hour and a half to kill. And so I really just sat and wrote notes about people's gaits, their gestures, their nostrils, their hats how a hat would be much too small for a head, and just, all the details that I possibly could to give these kind of like running cones as a young soccer player might run cones as an exercise, but also as just, something to have. So I have all these faces and I have all these parts of people, because you have to give that short sketch sometimes of a human being that is going to be that undeniable detail that then helps the reader to believe the larger scene, helps the reader to believe, which is the hardest part, the internal life of this character.
Yeah, right. Your character, Eleanor, is wonderful. I loved that she's sort of two different people. She's both, she's self-aware in a lot of times, often, like there's this one point where she says, why did I treat Ruthie this way? She reflects about the way that she treated her older daughter. And she's also clueless, every night she reminds her children of the details of their father's abandonment as a bedtime story. So I wondered if it was, I guess I wanted to talk about character and having inconsistency as part of character or tension within a character's personality. Did you ever feel like she needed more balance, more of one characteristic or the other, or do you like the idea that they're both there?
I think that ambivalence is the hardest thing to write, when somebody wants one thing and wants another thing. It's a very, very true emotion, and it's an incredibly hard thing to write well. What's much easier to write and what's much more interesting to read is someone who's obsessed with something. Yeah. So ambivalence is hard as a human trait because it comes across as inconsistency on the part of the writer. I think, you know, Jennifer Egan had come to Florida State when I was there in the English department and gave a talk. And one of the things was she said was she always likes to ask what contradictions her characters live with.
Mm.
And that was a fantastic lens. And I was writing Pure at the time, and I pretty much blanked out on the rest of the things that she was saying and just went through each of my characters. And I said, what is this one? Oh, I know exactly what that one, that the contradictions that that one lives with. What about this one? Oh, it's probably this. You know what I mean? I just went through each of the main characters. So it's something that I've used since at different times in the writing process. You're kind of stalled and you need a new way in. And it's just an interesting question to ask, because it's interesting to ask of yourself as a human being too. We all live with contradictions, things we want for our, the ways we want ourselves to be in the world and the ways we actually are and are quite aware of.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's great. Need and love are so intertwined in this book. The characters sort of confuse need and love oftentimes, needing to be needed and also needing others to take care of them. And I wonder if you could speak about this a little bit.
Yeah. It's funny because I had a new therapist last fall. And he asked me something like about myself in a basic way. And I came back and I said, well, I don't know, which self? Like, you know, me as a mother, as a daughter, as a partner, as a friend, like which, as a teacher, as a writer, I'm not exactly sure which one. And he's like, well, your base self. And I was like, again, I'd like you to clarify. You're going to have to be more specific because that's not working for me. It's also kind of interesting, but I can't remember the question even because it was not the thing that I learned at the time. But, yeah, so I think, you know, need and needing to be of use and being needed in the world and being acknowledged for the ways you are of use are how you feel loved in so many ways. Mm-hmm. So it actually kind of goes back to your earlier question about my mother. Did I challenge my mother's overprotectiveness? And I was like, no, I kind of allowed that to be symbiotic, and I allowed her to love me the way she needed me to.
Mm-hmm.
My love for her was, I'm going to allow you to continue to be needed. And also, I'm going to benefit because I still need you.
Mm-hmm. Right. So do you think that's universal, or do you feel like these characters are maybe using need and or confusing need and love a little more than usual? I mean, and as you said, some of this is an exaggerated presentation, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, that would entail me understanding how other human beings operate in the world. I only have my one anecdotal experience in the world, and you know, it's messed up in its own very specific, twisted way,
right.
Which hopefully makes me a better writer, but maybe a stranger person. So obviously, probably not, right? Some people, you know, I mean, I have a husband who he makes my writing life possible. So, I mean, he does the laundry, the dishes, the blah, blah, blah. He really takes care of the household. And then he reminds me of, like, you're actually going to talk to somebody today at 11 o'clock, Juliana. Remember that. So, in some ways, the benefits of people around me I have incredibly codependent and symbiotic relationship with my husband. We've been married 22 years.
So it works.
So, so love and need, you know, we're each other's legs. So we wouldn't really be able to walk without each other properly, I think.
Right.
So, but you know, certainly other people, particularly other women, have fought very hard to walk on their own, and to make that a very important part of their lives, and to not be, you know, needed in some ways, and to not need others because their independence is incredibly valued. And fought for, you know, and valued because it's fought for.
Right.
So I realize that I'm, you know, in that way it's unusual and perhaps more particular to this family's mythology.
Yeah, although I think that it speaks, this family will speak to a lot of people. I totally recognized it, let's put it that way. You know, I feel like...
And my friend who identified with Ruth... in the book, you know, it's because of her, you know, strident desire and you know, self-possession, you know, to make her way in the world,
right.
Even though that meant kind of abandoning someone possibly, but going forward. So she's in there.
Right. Yeah, and I guess your characters are all representing, I mean, not that they're just representing a certain personality type, but they're all different enough that mm-hmm. different people are going to get different things out of their narratives. Okay, let's see. How much did you develop the Daisy and Weldon story for your own use outside of what you included in the book? You have a lot of references to those books and quotes that the fans of Harriet Wolfe love to recite. So how much did you develop that?
There are earlier drafts where there's much more of them.
Okay.
So there is more. But, I mean, to me, my feeling about them is that I read those books in my late teens, early 20s, going mm-hmm. into college. And
right.
now I'm my age looking back on them and kind of what remains.
Yeah.
So that's kind of about as much as I know about them.
Yeah, okay. Now, this may be a similar thing to your bin on your desk, but I loved this way that you put something. At what point Eleanor admits to having tried to write a seventh book for her mother's readers, the missing book, mm-hmm. Mainly for financial reasons, and she failed. She says, "My sentences sounded propped up with toothpicks." I loved that. I thought it was the perfect way to describe how it feels when the writing isn't flowing. And I wondered if you're very prolific. You write a lot. So do you feel like there are times when it all feels propped up with toothpicks?
Yeah, I do. It's very frustrating. and those are days when I need to stop and go back to reading what I love. And I need to hunt around until I find the book, the right book. So there's a lot of my reading life. A lot of times people say, "Oh, did you read such and such?" And I don't know how to answer the question because I've read it in a panic. Like, rummaged it, you know what I mean, for something that will help me. Like, I'm, trying to read a map on I-95 in a convertible, you know what I mean, to get to a hospital for somebody I love. It's a very strange thing. Because there's some books that I read for blueprints. You know, I want the whole overarching sketch thing. But then there's also these books that are kind of portals to my own book. It's actually this, what I'm working on now. Every night I read a handful of books, and then you'll wear one out and it no longer opens the portal for you.
Mm.
But you kind of are reading, and then your own characters start to say, their own things, and you're writing in the margins to kind of keep up with the things you want to do the next day. That's how I, and so the books can be very, very different. You know, I can be reading, the hours for something that's, very sci-fi and fantasy, but he's so good at interiority that that's the book I need to give the science fiction fantasy thing, the characters more depth
okay.
of emotion. So, yeah.
Interesting. Huh. I want to talk a little bit about presenting things through a character's specific perspective. For example, I love Tilton's description of Ruthie, which is filtered through her own love of birds. And the description is, "Head and body rather elongated, small bulk, dorsal slightly hunched, as if she's not exactly sure of herself. Teeth large, white, but unevenly serrated because she left before she got braces. Eyes wide, blue, the tip of her nose compressed and slightly decurved. Her hair generally close, rather compact around her face. Fringe of bangs sweeping her arched eyebrows. She's still pretty." And I loved, I felt like this is a person who's been taking notes about birds in a notebook for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder if we could talk about presenting things through a character-specific lens.
Yeah, I read Audubon. I mean, I just went to bird books, and I read, and I got used to that language. I mean, decurved is a very specific term. And so I really, then I started just looking at people in terms of their bird anatomy and started describing them that way, because that's really, she's described more birds and seen more birds than she's seen human beings. So, live in her kitchen. So, so that's what I did. I just read Audubon.
Yeah. One thing that I liked about it is it's not just specifically bird language. There's the, mm-hmm. there's the fact that she left before she got braces.
Mm-hmm.
There's the fact that perhaps she's not exactly sure of herself. It's a nice mix of the kind of stuff that gives Tilton also, a real sense of humanity. And anyway, yeah. Okay. You didn't use any quotation marks in her sections, in like the dialogue. So how did you decide to do that?
Well, first of all, I was dead set against the idea of writing four characters in first person. It seemed to me like the wrong thing to do to the reader. because the danger there is that in any given section, they start to forget who I represent.
Right, right.
So one of the things, so I could get it down to three because I put Harriet in italics. Because it's a written document, so I got to put her in italics. Okay, now I'm down to three. You always know that you're in Harriet because you'll look at the page and the page will indicate.
Right.
And then I felt like, okay, I can get rid of Tilton because her way of speaking is so uniquely her own that I could kind of, okay, people will know when they're in a Tilton chapter. It's very specific. So that really got me down to Ruthie and Eleanor and trying to make them as specifically different as possible. And so very early in each one of their chapters, I put in something that only they would say, and they have ways of speaking that are, you know, specifically themselves. And so, so I was very mindful in making their voices distinct.
Yeah. It's funny, too, because Ruthie and Eleanor are probably the two who would see themselves as least alike, whether or not that's true.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about what you're writing now. Do you talk about that when you're
I do. Yeah, I don't have a problem. Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a novel coming out in November. It's under my Bridget Asher pen name, and it's coming out with Random House, and it's called All of Us and Everything. And it's family, and it's sisters mainly, three sisters this time, set in Ocean City, New Jersey, after Hurricane Sandy. And so it's much more comedic. It was a blast to write. So that's coming out. And then, I mean, currently I feel like sometimes I have to push off from what I've just written. So I'm working on something that's, you know, again, kind of big world building, more like Pure, multiple points of view again, but probably all in third person. And yeah, so a very different kind of world than exists.
Okay. Your pseudonyms are Bridget Asher and N.E. Bode. I wondered if you feel like a different author altogether when you're working on these projects by these separate authors or pseudonyms.
Bridget Asher and Juliana Baggett get closer and closer together all the time. And to the point where I'm like, you know, is All of Us and Everything really an Asher novel? I'm not so sure. I mean, it's definitely Baggett all over it, I feel like. So those two certainly blend together. But N.E. Bode, I wrote kid books pretty much like for 5 to 7 years, and there are about 7 books in there, and I haven't written any kid, like middle grade whimsy, dark whimsy, as I call it, in a while. But N.E. Bode, definitely I'm like a very different person. I have a very different way of speaking and expressing myself. I would find myself while I was writing those books writing a tenure letter for somebody. I would be in Bode voice, and I'd realize about halfway through and say, oh, no, this won't do at all. No, this is helping no one. He's hilarious. I adore him. But no, Bode is not the person to write your tenure letter.
Oh, that's funny. What are you reading these days? Are there any books that you've read recently that you would recommend people have a look at?
I do. I was just talking to somebody this morning about My Sunshine Away, which is a debut by M.O. Walsh. I am reading Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, along with hopefully the rest of America, about race relations in this country, and it's written to his son, and that's been very formative for me as a parent and a citizen. Let's see, what else is just around me? Oh, I just got the, speaking of the kind of, the beautiful writer, Jeff Vandermeer had written in the LA Times about Clarice Lispector and her complete stories that are out.
Yeah.
So that's a big, fat, Bible-sized book that sits on my bedside table that I'm not reading front to back, but I'm reading out of order. So those are a few things.
Okay, great. Thanks. So I just basically have one last question for you. In your classes and also on your blog, which I was having a look at the other day, you talk about plotting by secrets. And keeping in mind that many of the show's listeners are writers, I was wondering if you can offer some advice about plotting by secrets.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a secret can best be described as a spring in a box, you know, or like a, you know how they used to do the peanuts and you'd open the peanut thing and, as a gift, and then, you know, the snakes would spring out or whatever. The secrets are, you know, coiled and tensed, and the unsaid secret holds a lot of power. And so you kind of have to decide when to detonate them, you know, when to open the box and let them spring out. And
right.
If you think of them as not just springing out and coiling and then rolling around on the carpet, but you think of them as being that spring as being coiled energy that then propels into space and then creates, you know, other things to happen. It's, you know, it turns the gear. It starts an engine. It's energy put into the story that has ramifications. Then that,
right.
You know, that's incredibly effective in terms of, you know, plot, you know what I mean? And it's also a really character-based plot because it's rooted usually in backstory. It's rooted in something that someone has firmly held on to and kept to themselves. So it's I feel like it's a very nice kind of way of looking at plot for people who don't particularly necessarily like to look at plot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's really like, in the best moments, character equals plot, and plot equals character, and those two things are not pulled away from each other. And I think plotting by secrets is one way in which they're very much tied.
Right, because the secrets are wrapped up in the desires of the characters, or
right.
or in the fears, or yeah,
yeah.
Actually, I feel like that also relates a little bit to missing mm-hmm. objects, or missing people, or missing books. Also.
That's right.
Ties in with the secrets. I mean, would you say that the secret of what happened to Harriet Wolfe's Seventh Book of Wonders is you know, sort of the plotting by secret of this book?
It is, I think. And I'm starting, it's funny, I've never had a book that makes people cry and has people emailing me and telling me that they cried. But what I've loved, too, is that people have been really specific about what made them cry.
Mm-hmm.
And you have different points in the book, multiple crying
yeah.
moments.
Wow.
Yeah. So that one has had an impact without giving anything away.
Right.
That has had an impact on readers.
I want to thank you so much for being on the show. The book is Harriet Wolfe's Seventh Book of Wonders, a novel by Juliana Baggett, published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Juliana.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Juliana Baggett. You can learn more about her work at her website, julianabaggett.com. There you can also read about the works of Bridget Asher and Annie Bode, which are Juliana's pen names. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Juliana Baggett, who encourages her students to use visualization to move forward in a narrative. She suggests that her students close their eyes for each. They can take notes in between. Here are a few examples she offered from which you can work. Either now, if you're all set up to do it, or later, listen with your eyes closed and try to visualize what's happening but missing from each prompt. A man walks out of a house. He's dressed very strangely. He walks to a car, opens the trunk, looks inside, reaches in. A woman is running scared. Where? She runs out of breath. Falls to her knees. She hears something, looks up and sees something. A man is sitting on a park bench. By his clothes, we assume he works as a something. A woman sits next to him and says something that makes no sense to us but means a lot to him. A woman stands in a flooded basement. Things float and are soaked around her. She finds a footlocker, wades over to it, reaches inside to find. And finally, a boy in pajamas is outside. He's alone. He hears something but ignores it and keeps heading toward. So have a listen to all of those again. Back up your recording a little bit. And think about what those somethings are and what those scenarios offer you in the way of creative inspiration. And fill in the blanks. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like Jerry Bears, Eyeballs, Peace Signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook.
Right, the book and the radiator are also supported by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary Lee Miller will be back in October with his next show. Gary's website is garyleemiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.